Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Sue Udry of the Defending Dissent Foundation, who discusses some major concerns about government mass surveillance and the reform civil liberties groups will be advocating the next president and Congress adopt. Matt Wood of the media democracy group Free Press, who takes a critical look at the proposed merger between telecommunications giant AT&T and Time Warner. And Yale University dining hall worker Corey Menefee, who broke a stained glass window depicting slaves harvesting cotton, talks about the campaign to change the name of Yale's Calhoun College, named after a pro-slavery senator. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Guardian newspaper reports a local government environmental official in the Brazilian Amazon, Luis Alberto Araujo, was shot and killed in his car in front of his family on October 13. The shooting of Araujo, the secretary for the environment on his city council, took place in the small town of Altamira in the eastern Amazon state of Pará. His murder was similar to well-known assassinations of rainforest protectors like Chico Mendes and Dorothy Strang. Since 2012, more than 150 environmental activists have been killed in Brazil, with studies showing the country accounts for half the global toll of such murders. Billy Kite, campaign leader at the NGO group Global Witness, observed that the killing of Luis Alberto Araujo marks a new low in the war waged against environmentalists in the Brazilian Amazon. He went on to say that the murder sends a message that no one is untouchable. Araujo's work, combating deforestation, had provoked a series of death threats. Federal officials had shut down a gold mine and broke up a deforestation ring that used slave labor to clear-cut 112 square miles of rainforest. Araujo also sought fines against the nearby Belo Monte hydroelectric dam for killing 16 tons of fish. Before the Citizens United Supreme Court ruling in 2010, multimillionaire Art Pope played a major behind-the-scenes role in the rightward drift of the North Carolina Republican Party. But once Republicans won a legislative majority in 2010, Pope has been in the driver's seat. Under Governor Pat McCrory, Pope briefly served as budget director and succeeded in implementing deep budget cuts in education and welfare programs. This spring, Pope's influence extended to the so-called bathroom bill, House Bill 2, that required transgendered people to use the bathroom of their biological birth. The law also banned any minimum wage increases or anti-discrimination statutes that local governments might adopt. Passed after the legalization of gay marriage, the bathroom bill provoked a serious backlash, with artists including Beyoncé and Bruce Springsteen canceling their in-state concerts. PayPal also abandoned plans to build an operations center in Charlotte. Pope's influence in the North Carolina state legislature can be seen in the passage of House Bill 589, which restricted ballot access in the swing state, cut back early voting, and eliminated same-day voter registration. The bill was passed only a week after the Supreme Court sharply gutted enforcement of the Voting Rights Act. The restrictions on voting rights, especially among African Americans, inspired the launch of the Interfaith Moral Monday movement led by Reverend William Barber, president of the North Carolina NAACP. This summer, a federal appeals court overturned key aspects of the HB 589 law, saying it purposely targeted African Americans, but early voting remains restricted in many counties. Once again, the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, appeared to be in trouble with the announcement that health premiums could spike 20% in the coming year. At the same time, there are signs of real progress, such as the 250,000 Louisiana citizens who signed up for Medicaid after the state expanded the program under Obamacare. Subsidies under Obamacare will protect most exchange enrollees from big premium hikes. Yet, plans on the state exchanges often don't offer the same benefits as those offered by employers, as insurers restrict consumers' choice of doctors and hospitals. According to the American Prospect magazine, In many ways, health plans on the ACA exchanges more closely resemble Medicaid designed for poor Americans than Medicare, which remains very popular with the American middle class. In most states, the debate over the Affordable Care Act remains frozen in time, and many Democrats are afraid to advocate for reforms to make Obamacare more competitive with other health plans. Many healthcare experts say that establishing a nonprofit public option is a key reform that would encourage competition within health exchanges and thus lower prices. The public option can make the exchanges more attractive to consumers, especially where private plans with broader networks are scarce. This is critical since big insurers like Aetna are dropping out of health exchanges. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
After former National Security Agency contractor Edward Snowden publicly revealed details about U.S. spy agencies' dragnet surveillance of Americans' communications, there was a push to enact reforms by both citizens and legislators. The USA Freedom Act, passed by Congress and signed into law by President Obama on June 2, 2015, mandates that telecommunications companies, not the government, will store phone metadata. The legislation also demands increased transparency from the Secret Foreign Intelligence Surveillance, or FISA Court, which has been criticized as a rubber stamp in approving government access to personal phone data. Under the new law, FISA Court judges will be allowed to, but not required, to appoint a friend of the court to argue on behalf of privacy concerns. Despite these reforms and others that have been enacted, critics maintain that mass surveillance of Americans' communication continues under Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. A coalition of digital rights and civil liberties groups that have accused the NSA and FBI of using Section 702's internet program, codenamed PRISM, to surreptitiously surveil Americans, have called on Congress to let FISA Section 702 die when it expires on December 31, 2017. Your reporter spoke with Sue Udry, Executive Director of the Defending Dissent Foundation. Here, Udry discusses some of her group's ongoing concerns about government surveillance, privacy, and security that the next president will need to address. She'll also review the major party presidential candidates' positions on these issues and the reforms her group and other civil liberties activists will be advocating the next president and Congress to adopt.
So the agenda is long, but to focus particularly on surveillance, at the federal level, we've got the program that the NSA used to authorize their PRISM program, which was exposed by Ed Snowden. That's the kind of the internet surveillance program that is allowing the NSA to just scoop up vast amounts of traffic that goes over the internet. The statute that authorizes that program is set to sunset January of 2018. That section, it's called Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act, which was passed back in 2008. We've got about a year to convince Congress that they should just let that sunset, and that's pretty unlikely, but it opens up the opportunity for us to talk about other needed reforms to surveillance with Congress and try to get them to pay attention to just the vast of the way the government at all levels is surveilling our lives. So just to run down real quick some of the things that have just come to light in the past couple of years, the FBI is creating a massive biometric database called Next Generation Identification, and they're gaining access to biometric data of, for example, they have agreements with many states to be able to scan our driver's license or state ID photos. They are collecting the photo IDs of every person who gets a visa into this country. They're looking at passport photos, and they're also being able to gather other biometric data like, well, obviously fingerprints, but also iris scans and all sorts of very sci-fi sort of bits of our body are going into this massive FBI database. So that's one huge thing at the federal level. And then across the states, we've seen police using Stingray devices a lot more, automatic license plate readers, a huge, huge surge in surveillance cameras just on the streets. So every time you walk outside, you just don't know if you're being recorded by a state surveillance camera. So those are just a couple of the things that we're worried about over the course of the next year.
So what do we know about Hillary Clinton's views on surveillance and the many groups and individuals around the country that are looking for reform and additional checks and balances on the government's power to surveil their communications?
Sure. Well, Hillary has a record on this. We don't really, you know, Donald Trump, you know, who knows what he says and whether he's, you know, believes what he says. But with Hillary, we actually have a voting record. So back in 2001, she did vote for the Patriot Act. And in general, she's not a hero on protecting our privacy, but she has done actually a couple of good things. In 2005, she voted against cutting off debate on whether or not to renew the Patriot Act Section 215. That's the section where the FBI is allowed to gather business records without a warrant. And that have been used to authorize the NSA's bulk collection. So she voted against cutting off debate. And then in 2008, she voted against the FISA Amendments Act, which is the bill that gave the NSA the broad authorities to scoop up internet communications. And that's also the bill that gave the telecoms legal immunity after we discovered about the huge amount of phone, how the telecoms were helping the FBI and NSA to spy on us. So she's done those good things. But then on the other hand, if you remember back in 2010, I think it was when WikiLeaks did the huge State Department documents, it was revealed that in 2009, Clinton had personally ordered spying on UN diplomats, including Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, and trying to get her people to collect things such as his internet passwords and his DNA. So she's kind of creepy. She's got kind of, you know, she's done a couple of okay things on surveillance, but in general, her statements in the campaign have not led one to believe that she's going to do very much to rein in either NSA or FBI surveillance of, you know, via internet or phone.
That was Sue Udry, Executive Director of the Defending Dissent Foundation. For more perspectives and commentary on reforming NSA surveillance programs, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In the march toward ever greater concentration of media ownership in the U.S., telecommunications colossus AT&T announced on October 22nd that it reached a deal to buy media giant Time Warner for $85.4 billion. This proposed mega-merger comes after Comcast's buyout of NBC Universal for $30 billion and Verizon Communications' purchase of Yahoo and the Huffington Post. AT&T is America's second-largest wireless carrier, a top broadband provider, and with its recent acquisition of DirecTV, a major pay TV company. Time Warner is one of the five leading U.S.-based media and entertainment corporations, which owns CNN, HBO, TNT, TBS, the Cartoon Network, Warner Brothers Studio, and much, much more. If the merger is approved, it would bring together one of the largest content distributors with a top content supplier. The deal will likely undergo scrutiny from regulators, including the Department of Justice, and possibly the Federal Communications Commission, if the merger involves the transfer of broadcast licenses. Many public interest groups have come out in opposition to the AT&T-Time Warner merger out of concern that consumers would be hit by stiff price hikes and a reduction in content choices. Your reporter spoke with Matt Wood, policy director with the media democracy group Free Press. Here he takes a critical look at the proposed AT&T-Time Warner merger and the positions of both major party presidential candidates, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump.
I think it's important not to lose sight in all the dollars and cents and the very important economic issues of the media concentration this would engender. And when it comes to just the sheer size of the company, of the political power that this company would control, AT&T is already one of the biggest spenders on politics, both in terms of campaign contributions and lobbying dollars. So adding Time Warner would not only give them additional money to spend on that kind of stuff, but also give them a foothold in the movie business, Warner Brothers on down. And they have the DC Comics franchise, which, of course, is a pretty popular one these days. There's the media diversity and the control over what we all see and get to watch every day on TV screen and more online as well. There is the political consolidation, if you will, and the fact that AT&T is a huge lobbyist already for wireless and broadband issues and now would be basically making its bed with MPAA, the Hollywood lobby that is itself indeed very powerful already. And then you get back to the dollars and cents for people around the country who would have to be paying off all that debt and all this money that AT&T will shell out for Time Warner if the deal is approved. It's funny because this is what sometimes called a vertical merger. AT&T is not so much heavily into the content business today. And so buying a movie studio and a bunch of TV networks that are in essence AT&T's supplier when it comes to the programming they sell on their own cable and satellite TV packages. Sometimes those vertical mergers are dismissed, and for the last several decades, they've been thought of as less dangerous than horizontal mergers, which is when you take out a competitor next to you in the same line of business. But we think vertical mergers are indeed dangerous, and luckily a few more antitrust academics and lawmakers are starting to come around to that theory. And what they do is they don't take out a current competitor for AT&T or Time Warner in any large way. But it gives a single company, if this kind of thing goes through, control over both halves of that distribution process. And so AT&T could use all the new content it owns against other providers of wireless and wired TV and internet service. I think Comcast and Verizon are pretty large and can take care of themselves, but also the smaller competitors like Sprint and T-Mobile. They can use this content they've acquired and try to drive up the prices of other providers' customers. You know, suddenly, not just Verizon and Comcast, but smaller competitors, smaller cable companies and phone companies around the country have to pay off one of their rivals in the form of AT&T if they want to get HBO or CNN content. And then AT&T can turn around and in that vertical relationship use the other half to its advantage as well against other content providers. They can say, well, we don't really need your stuff. We have our own, thanks. So they can play hardball when it comes to negotiating for content because they have so many hundreds of millions of wireless and wired communication services customers. So again, we think these vertical mergers are bad, and in fact, I don't know if you want to jump to this, but it's not just been groups like ours who thankfully have raised the alarm. Many senators and even the presidential candidates this late in the election took notice of this deal. That's how big it is with, I can't believe I'm saying this, but with Donald Trump actually sounding a good note of caution and really alarm about this kind of media concentration and control of too much power in one company's hands. And then Tim Kaine and others on the Democratic side of the ticket also expressing concerns when this deal broke last week.
What do we know about Hillary Clinton's position in the past on these giant mergers and any position she's taken on this current proposed merger between AT&T and Time Warner?
Yeah, I don't know that she's spoken on it herself, but Tim Kaine was on the Sunday talk shows last week and said it was a major cause of concern. And it's funny because Hillary Clinton, I think, has more of a centrist and pro-business reputation than some Democrats do, certainly than Bernie Sanders, her main opponent in the primaries, did. But then you'll hear people talking about how the Bill Clinton antitrust enforcement under Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission was actually more stringent than the Obama administration has been. So again, we've kind of seen a reawakening of interest in antitrust, especially during what was a record year for mergers last year and rolling into this one. But we kind of hit rock bottom when it comes to stopping these deals during the second Bush administration and the earliest part of the Obama administration. And so what would a President Hillary Clinton do? I mean, that's to be determined. The campaign has been willing to voice concern about this deal, even here in these last crucial days before the election. And we hope that any antitrust enforcer worth their salt would take a hard look at this deal, and we hope stop it. But, you know, that we're kind of a long way from getting to that formal process right now.
That was Matt Wood, policy director with the media democracy group FreePress.net. Find links to more analysis and commentary on the proposed AT&T-Time Warner merger by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Last July, a Yale University dining hall worker smashed a window depicting slaves harvesting cotton in the residential college where he worked, declaring he was tired of seeing that extremely degrading image. The name of that residential college, Yale's equivalent of a dormitory, is Calhoun, named for John C. Calhoun, a U.S. senator from South Carolina and later vice president of the U.S., who was one of the South's strongest proponents of slavery and white supremacy. Calhoun was also a Yale graduate. Corey Menefee is the worker who broke the window. He was arrested and resigned from Yale under pressure. But with strident community support, charges were dropped, and he was rehired to work in a different dining hall. Yale students had been conducting a powerful effort the previous year to pressure the Yale administration to change the name of Calhoun College. Last April, Yale President Peter Salovey announced that the name would remain as a way, he said, of raising awareness and confronting the racist legacy of the school. Student and community efforts have continued under the slogan "Change the Name," and on October 28th, the largest community-based demonstration to date took place as 200 people marched through downtown New Haven and ended on a plaza in front of Yale's president's office, where they attempted to deliver a letter to Salovey. When protesters were told he wasn't available, they vowed to return. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Corey Menefee, who attended the rally on his lunch break. Here he explains why he chose to break the window at Calhoun College and what he thinks should happen next.
Well, the window was brought to my attention maybe a week before. I had been working there about 6 months, but I never really paid it any attention, partially because I'm supposed to wear prescription glasses and I don't wear them. So, and the window's kind of high and it's dull. It's a dull window. I never really like paid attention to it until it was pointed out to me by actually an alum, believe it or not. And I don't know. It wasn't something that I was consciously planning on doing. It's just something that just sat uneasy with me, and over time, it evolved into my actions.
There was a lot of movement among students for some period of time to change the name of Calhoun College, and your action really jump-started a community response. There was a lot of support for you in court, and you did get reinstated. And now this rally, a few hundred people at it, marching around downtown and standing outside President Salovey's office, talking about the need to change the name. How does that feel to you?
Well, it feels good. It feels great to know that others share my sentiment and the dislike, not only for the image I broke, but the name John Calhoun dawning over a college. You know, that is such a contradiction, because John Calhoun wasn't about enlightening or uplifting anybody. He was about keeping people down and exploiting them. So that's why we're here. We want that name removed from the college.
What do you think about the people, and I know there are at least some African Americans who I've read believe this, that we should not change, Yale should not change the name because it's sort of rewriting history, and that the fact that he was the person he was is a way of educating people about slavery and about white supremacy. What do you think about that argument?
I think that argument is weak. I think most people are hiding behind the fact that the man was a racist. That was his legacy, racism. Racism is not acceptable or tolerable in our society today. It has no place anywhere, you know. Every now and then you hear about a famous someone losing their job for saying racist comments or being filmed doing racist things, you know. So it's very intolerable and it's unacceptable. If you want to teach history, fine. There's no problem with teaching history in a classroom setting, but you don't want to hang that name as a banner over a college. I don't believe so.
Because the name itself, just by the fact that it's there, it's honoring that person, right?
Yeah, you're honoring someone whose legacy is literally putting others down, and there's no place for that in modern society. You know, those are primitive thoughts to enslave a group of people. Those are primitive thoughts. You know, we're in a modern era, and there's no place for that.
Yale has a committee. I guess, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was after the incident with you where you broke the window and were arrested and all that. Yale set up a naming committee or a renaming committee to make rules about how to rename things on campus. And after they make their guidelines, then they're going to revisit Calhoun, I guess. What do you think about that approach?
Well, just what you said, we guess. Nothing's been confirmed by any office, any official office, that there will be a change. All we know is a committee was formed to decide what the guidelines and principles will be if or when they decide to rename anything. So that remains to be seen.
Corey Menifee, do you have any suggestions about what the name should be changed to?
Well, there are a lot of suggestions. You know, there are a lot of better names you can call, you can use. But James Hillhouse was a scholar. I believe he was a Yale grad right here in New Haven. Edward Boucher was the first African-American to earn a PhD right here on Yale University's campus. Those are just two examples. There are plenty of other positive names that you can use if you wanted to do that.
That was Corey Menifee, a Yale University dining hall worker who broke a window that celebrated slavery and boosted a campaign to change the name of Yale's Calhoun College. Find more news and commentary on the campaign to change the name of Calhoun College by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.